Everybody needs just the right amount of fuel to get going in the morning. For some, a nice McDonald's egg and cheese bagel is just enough to do it. Others might prefer a McDonald's bacon egg and cheese bagel. Or perhaps a sausage egg and cheese bagel. And there are those where nothing will do but a hearty McDonald's steak egg and cheese bagel. Four different breakfast bagels to get you going. Tomorrow morning, give your engine a head start at participating McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Welcome to Stories of Sacrifice, American POW MIA's podcast. I am your host and lead researcher, John Bearer. Welcome to today's show. The podcast you're about to hear is a rebroadcast of a previous interview I did with the niece of Sergeant Darrell Tidwell early last year. We wanted to update the podcast about Sergeant Tidwell because we are happy to now say the unknown graves at the Manila American Cemetery that are associated with his remains and the 18 others who were originally buried along with him at the Kabatatuan POW Camp Cemetery in Common Grave 212 has received a disinterment authorization from the Department of Defense. What this means is our forensic genealogy research and making contact with the descendants of the other POWMIAs who were originally buried together in Common Grave 212. Their families have all provided their family reference sample DNA to the Defense POWMIA Accounting Agency, and their remains have been transferred to the DPAA lab to be identified and sent home to their family for burial, finally, under a grave marker that has their own name. This process can take a few years to accomplish, but the families of Kabatatuan Common Grave 212 now have closure. I cannot wait to welcome Sergeant Tidwell home to his family, hopefully later this year. Please sit back and enjoy this rebroadcast of Sergeant Tidwell's story of sacrifice we did with his niece Elizabeth. Thank you for listening. We are joined today by the great niece of Sergeant Darrell A. Tidwell, who served with the 200th Coast Artillery Regiment and died at POW Camp Kabatatuan on 30 July 1942 and is currently buried as an unknown at the U.S. Military Cemetery outside of Manila, Philippines. His family is trying to get him identified and brought home for an honorable burial next to his parents.
My name is Elizabeth Baker, and my husband's great-uncle, Darrell Tidwell, is my POW. He was born April 13th, 1920, in Roosevelt County, New Mexico, and he was a lot older than my grandma, so she doesn't have a lot of memories of him growing up. She remembers that he would whittle little toys for her that she could play with, and she remembers like him driving her around in their old car and riding horses with him.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, she really only has a couple of memories. She was 8 when he left, when he enlisted. And she does remember, she has kind of a cool memory. The day that he left, he snuck into the house and hid behind the door and surprised his mom. Because I think they didn't think they were going to get to see him before he was shipping out for the war. But he got to come home. So he got to surprise them. And then the next day he had to leave. So she doesn't have a lot of memories because, I mean, like I said, he was a lot older than her. But she does. What? She remembers him as being like very funny and very kind and always wanting to make everyone around him smile and just being a really good big brother.
How old is his sister now?
She's 87.
Yeah, that other family I'm working with, Frank Kunick, is the service member's brother, still living, Frank Kunick Sr., and that's about the same age.
Really?
Yeah. Frank was really young, and when his brother went away to the Philippines too.
So she was 8 when he left and 10 when he died.
Did he ever write home to the family or send any letters?
She said she doesn't have any recollection of any letters or anything from him once he left. I'm sure he did. mean, I'm sure he wrote to his parents, but she was such a little girl. I think she just doesn't, she doesn't remember it. And if there were letters, they're not, we don't have them anymore.
Was she the only sibling to Daryl?
No, there were seven.
But she's the last that's living.
Seven. She's the last, yeah.
Now, did he have any other brothers that served? Do you know?
Yes. Their brother Gaston served in the Navy.
Oh, okay.
At around the same time. But he made it home and got married and had kids. And then he was well into his 80s when he passed.
So he served, he went into the Army. What unit do you serve with?
200th Coastal Artillery.
So they're a New Mexico National Guard unit. Yes. And then they were federalized and sent over to the Philippines. I think they were sent over there in June or July of 1941.
And I think they took some pretty big losses.
They did. And, you know, out of all the units that were in the Philippines, they have the most that are actually missing in action.
Oh, wow.
And the most at Cabatatuan that died at Cabatatuan and that are still listed as missing in action. There's, I think there was like 90-something of them.
That's crazy.
Do you know anything, you know, like, was he ever wounded in action before the fall of the Philippines, or
do you know? No, anything? Not that I know of.
So when they surrendered, he was probably down on the end of the Bataan Peninsula. Mm-hmm. And so he would have been a part of the Bataan Death March.
Yes.
Do you know anything about the march or any of that?
So the only thing that I know about him and the march was that a guy that was there with him and was liberated from the camp, that was from his unit, told Durrell's parents that he fell during the march and was shot and left in a roadside grave. But now we know that that's not true. And he actually died of dysentery in the camp.
Do you know who that, did the family ever say who that soldier was that told him that?
And I think his name is Ted Williams.
Ted Williams? I'll have to look him up.
Wasn't somebody that they, I don't think it was somebody that they really knew. I think it was somebody that reached out to them after, like, several years later.
I'll have to look him up and see if he's still living.
Oh, yeah, that would be cool. I'll see if I can check and figure out what his actual name is.
Okay.
Like his full name and see if I can find anything.
But with the case, so did your grandmother, is she the one that contacted the Army about trying to get him identified? Did they contact her?
No, I contacted the Army.
Oh, you did. So the Army had never reached out?
No.
In the last 5-6 years to say, hey, we could possibly identify him if we had DNA?
Nope, she didn't even know that. I don't think she believed me when I told her that I was going to call. Yeah, I think she thought that I was crazy.
Oh, no kidding. What are her thoughts about it now?
Oh, I don't know. She cried a lot. Did she? So in like the 1970s, her and her sisters got money together and bought a grave in their family plot in Dora, New Mexico. And they had a headstone made for him and they put it on it because she just felt that everybody needs a marker. Otherwise, no one will know that he existed, you know, that he was on this earth. So they had this gravestone made and there's this empty grave there. Well, nobody knew that it was empty. Like, that was never something that we talked about.
Uh-huh.
Until one day we were talking about it. And she said to me, like, very calmly, she was like, well, honey, he's not there. And I really thought she was on, like, some grandma metaphysical stuff. You know, like, because we were talking about going back to the cemetery. Like, taking her to the cemetery to visit. And she was like, he's not there. And I thought she was talking about, like, his soul or whatever. And then she told me after that, no, he's really not there because they never brought his body home.
Oh, man.
And that was the first I'd ever heard of it. That was the first most of our family had ever heard of it. Like, we didn't really know. And oh, my God, that tripped me out. That did not sit well with me at all.
Right. And
I'm a veteran. So I knew a little bit about DPA's mission. And I was like, nope, I'm calling. Like, I looked him up and he was listed active pursuit. So I'm like, nope, I'm calling. Like, we're not going to do this. So, but I really think she thought I was crazy. And then when the DNA swabs came in the mail, she was like, are you sure this is going to, like, is this really a thing? So, but then she cried when she found out that, so he was preliminarily ID'd in like the 1950s. He has an X number.
Mm-hmm.
He's X1805. When she found out that he was in an American cemetery in Manila and he wasn't in the side, was, you know, she had thought for all these years that, for 76 years, she thought he was just left on the side of the road somewhere. So when she found out that he was in the American cemetery in Manila and that there were markers and his name was on the wall, she cried for days. Like, she was so happy.
Uh-huh.
She just said it was like a really big relief to know that he was somewhere. I mean, it would be an even bigger relief to bring him home. But she spent all those years thinking that he had just been dumped somewhere.
Yeah, and see, and that's what a lot of these families, you know, that we've contacted, that's what a lot of them think. They think, you know, right after Bataan fell and they passed away in the prison camps, when the Philippines was liberated and they exhumed all these graves and they couldn't make identifications, the families were sent these telegrams that were saying, you know, basically that they had no clue where their loved one was located, and if any information came forward in the future, they would reopen the case. But what the families didn't know is these guys were actually buried in a grave in Manila American Cemetery. They were buried in a grave under a cross that said, you know, that basically says, here lies a comrade in arms, only unknown but to God.
Uh-huh.
So these families went on for, like you were just saying, 76 plus years now, and they don't realize that, you know, they could get their loved one identified.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that's the sad part. There's not, I don't think our government's done a very good job of making it known,
mm-hmm,
that this could happen.
For sure.
So it sounds like she's kind of excited about it.
Oh my God. Yeah. I honestly think even if I'm not successful and I never bring him home, she has gained such a sense of peace about it. Just knowing that he's somewhere. You know, she wants him to come home and she wants to put him in the plot next to his parents and she wants all of that, but at least she doesn't have to, at least she, some of her questions were answered, I think.
Well, and it's always, you know, I'm sure it was always something in the back of her mind every day, thinking that he was lost and
yeah,
you know, never to be found. At least she knows that he's in that cemetery.
So this is really, I don't know, it really hits home for me because I am a veteran. And yeah, like the idea of one, let alone thousands of service members left behind just bothers me. But also because my little brother was really, really, really injured in Afghanistan in 2010. And it was very bad. And the Red Cross called my parents. And, you know, it was like there were several hours when we didn't know if he was going to make it to Germany and then make it to Walter Reed, or if he was going to die on the way, but they told us to be prepared. And he didn't. Like, he made it to Walter Reed, and he's made a really, really remarkable recovery.
Oh, good.
And to me, I just think, like, I remember how horrible those couple of days were when we didn't know. You know, it was like, we don't really know if, we don't know what happened. We don't know if he's alive right now, if he's dead right now, like, we don't know what's going to happen. And it was the most horrible feeling of my life.
Yeah.
And then to think that she has dealt with, I mean, something similar to that, because obviously eventually your hope runs out and you just know that he's not going to come home. But originally they weren't even told that. They were just told that he was lost.
Right. Yeah. That he was missing in action. And
yeah.
And
yeah.
What takes us now, what takes us days or weeks to learn, back then it took them months and years.
Yeah. So I just can't imagine that she has dealt with, she's lived with that for 77 years. And I mean, I thought I was going to go crazy after 2 days with my brother, and my brother's still here. You know, I can go see him and talk to him whenever, but I can't imagine what that would be like to know not only that you lost him in a war, but that there's no place for you to go to honor him. And there's no, you still have so many unanswered questions. So that's another one of my, like, not only do I want to do it for her and for him, that's another one of my big pushes, is just to be like, I can't imagine as a sister dealing with that for that long.
Right. So he died at Cabatatuan. What grave was he in?
212.
Buried in 212. How many men were buried with him that day?
19.
19 total, including him?
Yes, 19 with him.
How many were identified after the war?
So 9 are listed as resolve. 1 is listed as closed because he was a Norwegian civilian. He was like a merchant marine.
Yeah, Ingrid. That's right. That's right.
Yeah, yeah.
Been a while since I worked on your case.
Uh-huh. And all the rest are unID'd.
List is missing in action. How long have you been working on this case?
A little over a year.
What was interesting, I remember now thinking back how I ran into you on Facebook.
Yes, yes. Okay, because I called DPAA, I start the case. I'm like, okay, I need to find somebody that knows more about this than I do. So I made a post asking for help, and you responded, and you were like, is this your grandma, and does she live here? Because you had been working on coal.
Yeah, I was working on coal. I was actually working on coal for another organization that I volunteer with, Purple Hearts Reunited. And I had bought a bunch of Cole's mother's personal belongings. It was her Gold Star mother's hat and some other stuff that was on eBay. And so that's what got me on to Cole. But then I started researching the grave, and I already had a bunch of this information. And then I seen your post on Facebook, and I said, this is more than coincidence.
Yeah. Yeah. That was so crazy.
It was. And so we've pretty much identified most of the families. And I know you've been so proactive in calling these other families to get them to provide family reference samples.
So I'm at 7.
So you've got 7 out of the
12. Well, I need 12. 12 will be 60%. Mm-hmm. And we have 7.
And I don't want to put you on the spot, but what is your thoughts about this 60% policy?
I mean, I get it. I understand it. Like, they have to prioritize. They can't dig. I mean, I'm sure they're grossly underfunded and understaffed. I'm not sure it's not maybe a little bit arbitrary.
Uh-huh.
Like, where did 60% come from? Like, why not 50? Why not? And especially because, well, you know, I don't know either. Because my, they think they know which grave.
Welcome to Parent Teacher Night. Oh, yes, Miss Garner.
If you have one of those airline credit cards, you're probably not earning double miles on every purchase.
You're right. My card only gets extra miles on some types of purchases.
With the Capital One Venture Card, you earn unlimited double miles everywhere.
Wait, but where can we use them?
You can use Capital One Venture Miles on any travel purchase.
Venture gets an A+.
Capital One, what's in your wallet?
Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com for details.
Mine is in.
Mm-hmm.
But we can't get an individual disinterment because they are keeping them all together and they won't do anything until we have the 60% of the family reference samples.
Right.
So I don't know. On the one hand, I have a lot of questions about it, but then I do understand that there needs to be a way to prioritize it. And if they don't have enough information about the grave, then of course they're going to go dig up another one before they do mine. But I do find it a little bit frustrating.
Well, I know a lot of some of the other families that I've been working with, you know, everybody's wanting them to switch to a DNA lead process where they actually exhume the graves and get the service members' DNAs, you know, the POWMIA's DNA, and then get all that into a database. And then when a family does inquire, they've already got a match.
I mean, that would make...
But it, like you said, it does come down to, I mean, that's a big chore in itself, but it does come down to funding and having the available lab space and things like that. And I think the DPA could do a better job of actually partnering with other organizations and nonprofit agencies to actually get this accomplished. But that's a totally different story.
I mean, I honestly, I just wish they would do more of like, even if they weren't in a target families, because every family that my family and then the other 6, none of them had ever been contacted at all.
Right.
So, I mean, even if they're not going to target, like maybe some kind of public information campaign, because people just have no idea.
Right. And that's another thing that we've talked about is you know, for like the Vietnam and Korea MIAs, they actually had a programmer in place where they actually researched them all and went and after the families and got family reference samples. I think, you know, both wars, they're in the 90 percentile of having family reference samples on file. But for World War II, they have it, and they're under 10%.
Oh, I did not know.
Last I heard, they were at like 6 or 7% is all the DNA they have on file for World War II. Oh. And they need to develop a program, a public program, where they actually go target these World War II families. You know, the longer that we sit here back here and wait, the longer the DNA in the grave degrades. And they might not get a viable DNA. And the longer that families' memories fade, you know, it's like the Cole family that we were just talking about here a few minutes ago. When you talked to, it was a cousin, and she didn't even realize that Cole was her cousin.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that has happened more than once. People are like, oh, no, I think you have the wrong family. And I have to be like, oh, no, ma'am, I assure you I do not. Like, it takes some convincing. Number one, that I'm not some crazy psycho person. But also because, I mean, and some of the people that I've found, they're just not, I mean, they're not distant relations, but they're not, they're younger, you know, and they never met the person. And if nobody ever talked about them, then, you know, they just don't know that that is their family member.
Right. And it's just like your grandmother. She never talked about her brother. You know, how you found out about the grave.
We knew that he had been in the death march, but I think we all just thought that he had been brought home because there's a grave. So we all, like, nobody ever questioned it. And then one day we were just sitting down talking and, well, I don't know, she just said that. And I'm telling you, it even took me a minute to realize, like, what she had just said to me. And then I was like, oh, okay, no, I am now obsessed and we're going to make this happen.
Exactly. So how many reference samples are on file now for
seven?
Okay. There's seven. And you said you needed 12 or 13.
Yeah. 12. So I have five more. Now these last five are proving quite elusive, but
yeah. And it's hard, you know, because when you're not the official army calling.
Oh yeah. That definitely makes, I mean, I definitely lead with like, here is the link to the DPAA profile and here's the DPAA's number. And I really would prefer you to talk to them than to me, but they're not going to call you. So let me just give you some information.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. You know, I just had another case with the 200 Coast Artillery. It was Juan Gutierrez. He was actually identified in 1950. He was sent home and buried at the Santa Fe National Cemetery. Well, through John Eakin's lawsuit, and them exhuming those graves for John's cousin, they determined that Juan Gutierrez was not in his grave in Santa Fe. He was actually in the DPAA lab in Hawaii. Oh. So the Army, I guess, assigned a caseworker to him, and they tried to find the family, and without any luck, from my understanding. So they started running ads in the Santa Fe newspaper, requesting if there was any family for them to contact the Army casualty. Well, they ran these ads for a few months, and then everything went quiet. Well, here, about a month and a half ago, I read a newspaper article. Actually, I seen it in Stars and Stripes first on Facebook, and then I went to the newspaper article in Santa Fe, in the Santa Fe newspaper, and the Army and DPAA went to the federal court there and was trying to get that grave in Santa Fe National Cemetery exhumed so they could get the remains out of there so they could actually identify who was in that grave. So I went back to the case real quick, and I actually found the family. The family had moved away from Santa Fe in like 1956. And they moved to Flagstaff, Arizona, and I don't think a caseworker was ever really assigned to that grave, to be honest with you, because any genealogist
would have,
with a little know-how, would have been able to because I linked it all to his sister's Social Security death index and all her last names from her marriages. Mm-hmm. And then found her obituary where she died in 2001. And then the family had put in a thank you in the Flagstaff newspaper. Thank you to the certain members of the public for providing services to her and all that other stuff. And it listed the family's name right there in the newspaper.
Yeah.
And so I went ahead and I typed up an email with all the supporting documentation. And I sent it to Greg Gardner, who is the manager, the branch manager there at the Army Casualty, and said, hey, here's this family. You might want to assign one of your caseworkers to follow up and actually find out who the primary next of kin is and who's authorized to handle the remains and things like that. You know, the official Army deal. Because I don't care who the primary next of kin is. When I do my research, I just make sure they're a viable DNA donor. Mm-hmm. And I'll let the Army sort out the rest. I kind of disagree with World War II cases having to identify all these certain members of the family. But anyway, I sent that email and I never heard a word back. So about 2 weeks later, I went ahead and I called a stepdaughter that I had identified. And I talked to her and she said, yeah, that some lady did call her and that she passed them on to the blood family. And so it did get handled. Thank God.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was just a simple case. And I don't understand why they didn't identify this family originally. But anyway, I know you've been very proactive in trying to search out these families and talk to them. Mm-hmm. And they've been. So I know you've said a lot of them were very surprised when they got the call from you or the email or.
Oh yeah. Message. Yeah. But all except for one, there's one family that I contacted that were like, no, we don't want to do anything. We don't want to disturb the grave. It's our belief that he is where he is and that's his final resting place. And we just want to leave him there. But aside from that, everybody else, I mean, they've all been really willing to help.
Yeah, and you know, that brings up a great point. You know, that brings up a great point when a family thinks that they believe in the sanctity of the grave, and I understand where they're coming from, but what they don't realize is it's not all him in that grave. Mm-hmm. These remains were all commingled, so there's probably two or three different men, parts and pieces of two or three different POWs in that grave. You know, and
yeah.
You know, that's the sad thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was really disappointed to hear that, but I mean, that's fine. I have 19 and I only need 12. So it's okay that there's one or two that don't want to participate, because at least I have, you know, I have more to try to work with.
Right. How has the DPAA and the Army Casualty been pretty responsive to you or?
Oh man, I think I am a giant pain to them. But your case hasn't
ignored you, have they?
No, I'm pretty sure that, no, I don't really, I'm not easily ignored. I don't really take that well. I'm pretty sure that my case manager just like winces when he checks his email every day and hopes that there's not one from me. For the most part, they've been okay, but they just, I don't know. They're kind of crazy about information. It took me forever to get a list of the men who have reference samples.
So they actually gave you that list though.
They did give me that. Yes. But I had to ask and I had to go dig through SOPs and I had to tell them like, no, I don't. It was very much a lot of like, okay, are you saying you're unwilling to do that or you're unable to do that? Like, it was a lot of semantics and reading regulations and saying like, okay, there's nothing that says that you can't give me this. This is not a privacy issue because I'm not asking you for the name of the person that gave the sample.
But they actually gave you the name of the POWs who do have family reference samples.
Yes.
On. See, and that's,
well,
that's
another no. thing. No, they didn't.
They just give you the numbers.
No, I gave them a list of the families that I had contacted and they confirmed who had samples.
Okay.
That was like our compromise.
Okay. So that you don't know, you only gave them, so you only know of the seven families. You don't know Okay.
I know the 7 that have samples on file right now.
Have you filed a disinterment request?
Yes. The individual one?
Yes. That you want him exhumed.
Yes. But no response. And technically, they're supposed to update you every 30 days. So every week or so, every few weeks, I send them another email asking for an update. And sometimes they update and sometimes they don't. I mean, I think really a lot of it is just that they don't have anything new to tell me. Like that it's just a huge process that it has to go through.
Right, right. Boy, it sure be nice to know if they actually have, you know, have assigned a researcher to this case and if they're actually pursuing the families.
Yeah, I have no idea if that's, I don't think so, because I would think that then when I contacted families, they would say like, oh yes, somebody already talked to, you know, it wouldn't be like, this is the first time they've ever heard of it.
Right. Cause I, you know, in some of these other cases I ran into where the Army has assigned a genealogist and I've talked to the families after the genealogist, the Army genealogist calls them. So I just wondered if they actually put your case to a higher priority and assigned a genealogist to the case and that they're actually working on it. It'd be interesting to know if they did.
I don't think so. That would be awesome though.
Yeah, it would be. It would be. And according to their policy, when a family calls in or when a family is starting to work on the case, that case gets moved up to a higher priority where they do this, but it doesn't sound like in this case they did it. So, and that's their policy.
I mean, maybe they have, and that would be amazing. So, but if they have,
I would have thought they would have updated you and let you know that in one of the many emails you sent.
No, I haven't been told that.
Okay. Is there anything that, you know, I guess we'll close this a little bit here. Is there anything that you want anybody to know other than if you get contacted by a family or a genealogist, please provide FRF samples?
Yes, it's not a scam. It's not anything. And it's not crazy. And it's real. We can't leave them over there. Like, can't be known but only to God for 76 more years. Like, yeah, we got to do something to bring them home.
I agree. Well, I want to thank you for getting on here and doing this with me. It's kind of tough, you know, when you have to talk about it sometimes. And I'm hoping for his sister's sake that this happens real quick for her before she.
Oh, I know.
You know.
Definitely.
Because even if they exhumed the grave today, it'd still be a few years down the road before they even make an identification, unfortunately.
Yeah, I know. It's a very, very long process.
It is. So. It definitely is. So, well, Elizabeth, I want to thank you for doing this. And thank you for your service and your brother's service. And please let him know that for us.
Okay, I will.
And if you have any questions or any more comments after we get off, I mean, please feel free to let me know.
Okay.
So, and it was great talking to you today.
Yes, you too.
Again, I want to take a minute and thank Elizabeth and the Tidwell family for bringing this story about Darrell and his sacrifice for our country during World War II. It is our hope that each and every one of these men will someday be identified and brought home to their loved ones. This has been a production of the U.S. POW/MIA Family Locating. You can find us on the web at www.uspow/MIAFamilyLocating.com. Thank you.
Looking for a way to make some quick cash? Well, making money with DoorDash is super easy, guys. I love riding my bike around the city, and now I get to do that while getting paid. With DoorDash, I get to pick my own hours and be my own boss. I get paid on my deliveries and keep 100% of my tips. Not to mention the sign-up process was so quick and easy. Guys, I'm telling you, just download the DoorDash driver app and see how easy it is to start earning cash today.
I haven't really woken up until I've had my McDonald's breakfast deal. And I know this is true because before breakfast, I put my phone in the refrigerator and couldn't find the keys that were already in my hand.
Nothing gets the morning going like the first sip of an iced coffee. Get any size and any flavor for 99 cents until 11 a.m. Price and participation may vary.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. McDonald's. I'm loving it.